On Tech News Today, we'll give you an update on Heartbleed and tell you whether it's safe to use the internet again. Also, Pandora gets sued by the music labels, and Google might split the Nexus phone line in two. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, April 18th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Apple and Android devices are worth at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day in conversation with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today in studio is Jill Duffy. Jill is a writer and software analyst who works at PCMag.com. And she's the author of Get Organized, How to Clean Up Your Messy Life. Welcome to the Twit Brick House.
Thanks, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
And you're also doing Twit on Sunday, I understand.
I am. I'll be back on Sunday.
I heard rumors that there's going to be like Easter foods around here.
So, a little spread.
Yeah, so I think you might be in for a surprise.
Awesome.
Or at least some hard-boiled eggs.
Excellent. So, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the show as well. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. Well, let's jump into the news, shall we? The Heartbleed flaw is fixed on a lot of websites, but not all, according to a report by Eric Hesseldahl on Recode. Eric is a senior editor for Recode and specializes in enterprise computing, and he's here to give us an update on what's happening with Heartbleed. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Great. So can you give us a sense of how many sites have been updated and how many have not? Where do we stand at this point?
So I picked this up from a blog post by the security company Sucuri. I'm probably slaughtering that pronunciation. Is S-U-C-U-R-I. And they do a lot of site security. They help a lot of WordPress sites and smaller sites with their security problems. What they did was they took the Alexa database of the top million websites and basically scanned for the Heartbleed vulnerability against that list. And what they found was that the 1,000 most popular websites, starting with Google, on down through Pinterest and on down through, you know, basically the top 1,000 that most of us would use on a day-to-day basis, they're all okay. They've all been cleaned up and are ready to rock and roll. Once you get down into the most popular 10,000 sites, then there's only 53 that are still vulnerable. It's when you get down into the most popular million that things start to get a little bit dicey, because that's when there's something in the order of about 20,000, which statistically speaking is about 2%. So still pretty good odds right now, but still enough just to give you a little bit of pause, I would say.
Hmm. So if, let's say, a user freaked out about this bug when they first heard about it, they rushed out and changed all their passwords maybe last week, do they need to change them again? What would your advice be?
Well, it depends on how recently. If they changed the password before the vulnerability was patched, I mean, there's a time differential there. If you change before the vulnerability, you basically changed your password while the site was still vulnerable. And so theoretically speaking, you might have a problem. So, you know, if the 1,000 sites that you are concerned about are within that 1,000, and I have a link to the first 500 of them there. So it's pretty much, you know, most of the sites that any of us would be using on a day-to-day basis, you're probably okay. Although, you know, it's always a good idea to change your passwords. I always like to advise people to use something like a 1Password or something like that. Incidentally, as a side note, I got a note today. I happen to use 1Password, and they sent out a note that they were never using SSL in the first place, so their passwords have always been secure. The password key files that you store have always been secure. So, you know, that's actually a pretty good way to store your passwords.
Yeah, you know, the topic of password managers, I think, is really important here. Because of the Heartbleed bug, you want to not only change your password when you find out that any sites you're using have had the bug fixed, but you also want to make sure that you have a unique password for every single site that you use, because that's going to lead to the worst case scenario, which is a site that is protected still being compromised because your password itself was compromised because you've reused it.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And that's actually, it's you know, we could probably do an entire show on this, but the 1Password tool, which I am an enthusiastic user of, I don't have any interest in the product itself, but I do use it. So it has this one really advanced option. You can save your key ring into Dropbox. And so therefore, it can always be changed. So I have two Macs, and then I have an iPad and an iPhone. And so my keys are always, my passwords are always accessible and they're always in sync, even if they change. If I change it, you know, say my Gmail password on one, my Gmail password is in sync on all three of the other devices. And so it's a really great feature, really easy way to manage it. It makes it a lot easier to take care of that and to change your passwords whenever you want to or need to.
You know, Eric, we were reading earlier today that the Tor network may be affected because of the Heartbleed bug as well. The problem is that servers running Tor are going to be rejecting any messages trying to come through them because they have the bug. Can you tell us a little bit more about this? Do you know anything that's going on with the Tor network?
Yeah, I know a little bit about this. And I've been meaning to talk to some of the people involved. Here's what I know. And you can read these articles as well as anybody else can. The Heartbleed bug, you have to remember how this works, is that it allows an attacker to get in there and grab active data that's currently stored in active memory. So if someone has just entered their username and password to get into an account or something like that, an attacker can go in and scoop out whatever's randomly sitting there in memory, save it, it's unencrypted, and work with it later. And mine whatever data is in there. You can do that repeatedly, repeatedly, repeatedly. You can get an awful lot of data. So what it turns out is that a lot of the servers that are used to protect traffic on the Tor network were vulnerable. They were running older versions of OpenSSL and were therefore vulnerable to the Heartbleed bug. Now, keep in mind that the NSA, the National Security Agency, has been looking for a way in to Tor for quite a while. And they are alleged, and through some reporting done last week, to have let this Heartbleed bug percolate, as it were. And so I'm basically kind of putting a couple of different things together. Perhaps this was one of the reasons that maybe the NSA didn't disclose that it knew about this this bug after it audited the OpenSSL code, as it is alleged to have done, although it has denied that. So you can kind of start putting a couple of things together here. I'm just kind of wondering out loud as I talk to you about it. But so what has happened on the Tor network since is that about 20% of the servers that have been used to kind of obfuscate the traffic, and I'm not going to get into the details of how Tor works, you can look that up, have been taken offline until they can be basically kicked out of the network until they've been updated for new OpenSSL and no longer vulnerable to Heartbleed.
Now, Eric, just to get back to your Dropbox trick, is that risky? Or what if your Dropbox account is compromised?
Dropbox generally is pretty strong. The best thing I would say to do is turn on two-factor authentication for Dropbox. Of course, nothing is perfect. Nothing is absolute. But I've generally felt pretty secure about doing that. And the other option is iCloud. That's another, if you're a Mac user, iCloud is another option for syncing your keys.
And one final quick question. You seem to indicate, if I read you correctly, that there are some attackers who could be using Heartbleed scanning sites, the ones designed to inform users which sites are secure and which aren't, that they're using these sites to look for unpatched servers to attack. Is that what you are reading in all that?
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. I mean, open information is open information. Good guys know it, bad guys know it. So there's no reason that you know, I don't have any evidence to say that bad guys actually are, but, you know, they have the access to the same information that you and I do. So if you wanted to try and exploit this this Heartbleed bug on a vulnerable server and still felt that there was a criminal opportunity to do that, why not?
Yeah, I was thinking about becoming a notorious international cyber criminal, so this is good information.
Yeah, I hear there's good money in that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Occasionally.
Good work if you can get it. Well, Eric, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
You can find Eric Hesseldahl at recode.net, of course, and on Twitter at AHESS247. Well, in a sec, we're going to tell you about something terrible happening in Pandora Media. But first, I want to tell you about Gazelle. Gazelle is a place that will buy your used gadgets. Why would you want to sell your used gadgets? Because they're not doing you any good in that drawer, or the box, or in the garage, or wherever they're sitting around gathering dust. They can be earning you some real money so you can buy an iPad or a Moto X or an HTC One or some other new gadget. Or you can just pocket the money, or you can drink it away, whatever you like to do with the money. It's your the device is value that belongs to you, and it is also an environmentally friendly thing to do. The truth is, the horrible truth is that smartphones and devices are environmentally unfriendly to manufacture, to recycle, and so on. And so the only environmentally friendly smartphone is one that is never manufactured. By putting your old devices back into circulation, which is what Gazelle will do, you're actually theoretically preventing a new smartphone from having to be manufactured, because all of these currently unused devices are just sitting around. And so it's good for the environment for you to use Gazelle. I strongly recommend it. Just go to gazelle.com. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Find your phone, indicate the condition, and they'll give you a price. The prices I found in my experience are much higher than you might expect. They pay you fast, either by check or by PayPal, or my favorite option is with an Amazon gift card, because they'll pay you 5% more for your device. Payment is fast and easy. It's risk-free, and the offers are good for 30 days, which is really a cool thing. Gazelle's paid more than $100 million to over 700,000 happy customers. So find out what your Apple or Android device is worth. Take a minute. Go to gazelle.com to find out, and do it now, because your device may lose value the longer you wait. Well, Pandora Media has been sued by major record labels over non-payment of music recorded before 1972. And this is a really interesting case, because there's a disagreement between the federal law and state laws. My understanding of this story, Jill, is that the federal law says, you know, anything before a certain date in 1972, you can't really monetize that. But then states like New York State are, in fact, sort of cracking down on this sort of common law notion of the value of these songs. And so here Pandora finds themselves facing this lawsuit. What do you think of all this? Do you think that Pandora has a good case, essentially saying that because federal law says that you don't have to pay royalties for songs before 1972, or do you think that the music labels have a better case?
I think that we have to pay artists for the work that they produce, no matter when they produced it. Some of the songs that we're talking about here are like old classics that you're going to get play out of for decades to come. And I think that those people need to get paid. They need to be reimbursed. The music labels themselves, of course, have a very strong legal body behind them. I mean, they're going to take this to the courts. They're going to battle it out, and they want their money. I think what we need to see, though, is a shift in the future, not for these older pieces of intellectual property, but newer music, to get more money into the hands of the actual artists themselves, rather than routing it all through the record companies. So I think this is an interesting case, because it's looking back at some of the older content. But that's probably not going to be the major ground to be fighting on, I think, in the future.
Yeah. One of the people who's driving this initiative on the side of the record labels is the widow of Buddy Holly, because, of course, Pandora currently plays Buddy Holly songs and doesn't pay the estate of Buddy Holly. Jason, what do you think about this? At what point do songs become sort of in the public domain, do you think, in your opinion? When should they come in the public domain?
You know, that's a difficult question for me to answer entirely, because I think my thinking 20 to 30 years ago about what, you know, oldies were versus now, where now oldies to me feel somewhat contemporary compared to like songs from like the 20s, 30s, and 40s, which in my mind do feel like they're so long ago that they should be public domain, and I think they actually are. But when you take that and you apply it to things like, you know, music from the Beatles catalog, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, you know, that whole era of music, like you said, Jill, that's kind of timeless in a certain sense and still in a strange way current, and currently popular with many people, then yeah, it does feel kind of weird that money wouldn't transfer. I think what you're also seeing here is just kind of part of an extension of what the music industry is doing right now and is very concerned with, is the fact that online music, as you say, doesn't pay as well as, you know, say, purchasing a hard copy on CD and then, or album before it, or cassette before it. And so the labels are really looking for ways, I think, to kind of make these online music services somewhat irrelevant. And I'm not saying that it's wrong of them to do this, you know, in this particular case, but they're really looking for ways to do that, because they're not making as much money from these kind of streams as they used to from hard copy sales. And I don't think that they like it very much. And even artists right now, you know, if they're big name artists that have been, you know, around for decades, they aren't really too stoked by a large degree on these new ways of music distribution either. Newer artists maybe aren't as afraid of it as the legacy artists are. So that's part of what you're seeing here, too, I think.
Yeah. So in this ruling, a federal judge in Manhattan actually said that they have to, that Pandora is going to have to pay 1.85% to the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. And Pandora came back and said, that's too much money. 1.85% doesn't sound like a lot to me. I mean, I think we're talking about millions of dollars here. So maybe that's, you know, all those tenths of percent really do add up in this case. Mm-hmm. But I wonder how much money Pandora is making. They're the biggest source right now for online streaming music.
Right. And their model essentially is that, you know, they pester you with advertising until you finally give up and you pay a subscription and then there's less advertising. But it's a low margin business, and they're competing against, you know, they're facing a grim future where they're going to be competing against companies like Amazon and Apple, who may be subsidizing this kind, you know, that kind of model. And that's a tough business. So they're just trying to figure out a way to survive. And I think their survival is at stake in cases like this, because again, their margins are so thin. This complaint follows a similar suit filed last year against Sirius XM. And so, you know, this is going to be an interesting case for them. You know, it's to a certain extent, though, it's like join the club. I mean, I remember all those old TV shows that used to be in reruns for decades, like Gilligan's Island and I Dream of Jeannie. Those yeah. actors were paid like tiny amounts of money for the shows and never made anything for reruns. So poor Marianne is like living in poverty somewhere. And, you know, as these studios made a lot of money on them. So this goes far beyond just the music industry. There's a huge problem with how you deal with these older,
yeah, you know, it's complex in the sense that, you know, I saw somebody in the chat room that said, you know, knee-jerk reaction would be lifetime of the artist and then an extra 10 years beyond that for being paid. Yep. And, you know, that, I mean, part of that kind of sounds fair, but even beyond that, there's still money being made past that 10-year mark. And now that money is just going to anyone and not going to anyone associated with what made that song, you know, special or anything like that. And we're talking potentially a lot of money. So is that fair? I don't know what's fair, you know, as far as this is concerned. But,
you know, I was at a Spotify event a few months ago, and they were announcing at that point that they had just signed Led Zeppelin into their fold. And that made me kind of wonder, I don't know a whole lot about the legal side, but it made me wonder, how does a company like Spotify handle its music licensing differently from Pandora? I'm not a big Pandora user. I do like Spotify a lot. So I'm assuming, though, that there's something about the way that Pandora releases its music and signs or maybe doesn't sign contracts with some of the companies and labels that represent those musicians.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and it's nice to see Spotify giving Led Zeppelin a whole lot of love with that sort of...
I see what you did there.
Yeah. somebody had to say something like that. well, it's certainly an interesting case. And there, of course, is another extreme, which is that if anybody sings Happy Birthday, the Happy Birthday song, on national TV or something, they have to pay royalties for that.
Even though
the people, if you trace back who owned the original royalty, they didn't even write the song. They wrote the lyrics. And they copyrighted it or trademarked it, or I think they copyrighted it actually, because they were concerned about sheet music piracy. Yeah. So it's the whole thing is all messed up. And I would like to see this whole tension between the national and state models for how these things are enforced or what the law is to be resolved. Cause it's pretty crazy to have these disparate, you know, where you can just, you choose your court system, you know, based on the outcome that you want. It's a pretty lousy state of affairs. Well, Google might split its Nexus phones into two models, a very low-cost phone and a very high-quality phone. A credible report coming out of China says Google's low-end phone could cost about $100 unlocked. That's pretty cheap. Other reports suggest a high-end Nexus 6 phone with an up to 20-megapixel camera, some are saying 18 megapixels, and a very high-resolution screen. Now, Jason, I think this would be a great idea if they did this personally. I think that, you know, the whole Nexus model of creating this phone that's easy to take apart and very open for people to tinker with and for all kinds of people to play around with. I think it's great to have a very high-end model and a very low-end model, kind of like the Chromebook world where you have this very high-end Chromebook Pixel and then you have very low-cost Chromebooks.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much just all about accessibility to all. You know, low-cost hardware is certainly where Android has kind of reigned supreme for quite a few years now. But in the last year, we've gotten into ultra low-cost hardware, but not at the expense of good hardware. You know what I mean? It's low-cost. You have the Moto G, Motorola's Moto G, that was ridiculously inexpensive for an unlocked device. And I think that's kind of what you're seeing here, is that Google's saying the Nexus, you know, program was kind of all about making nice hardware available to everyone that wanted to be a developer on the Android platform. Now let's make it available to even more people. You know, if Motorola, which you know used to be ours, was able to do that very successfully with the Moto G, then why can't we do that too with the Nexus brand? I'm also very interested in the fact that the next, you know, incarnation of the Nexus 6, if these kind of leaks and rumors and discussions, whatever reports, whatever they are to be believed, that would be LG's third Nexus in a row. So we're kind of getting to that point where it's like, wait a minute, is the Nexus line about giving different hardware manufacturers a you know, their own chance to kind of shine in the spotlight and create, you know, this great hardware? Or is it just LG now? What's going on there?
Yeah, they're interesting reports. And Jill Duffy, I don't know if you've used a Nexus phone before. Or have you ever owned one?
I have not owned one, but I've tinkered with a number of different phones in my time testing software.
Yeah, I owned one for a while. I ended up moving to the Moto X. I loved it at first. There's certain things about it I loved. I loved the Photosphere feature, which enables you to take these 360-degree photos. I love the fact that for some reason I was able to get past AT&T's policy on tethering, and I was able to tether without paying for it, essentially. That was great. I love that. But the phone had a kind of cheap feel to it, which I didn't appreciate, and I really preferred the Moto X's, you know, always listening, yeah, kind of thing. But I'd love to see this going into this direction. Now, just to be clear, as Jason indicated, these are unconfirmed reports. Nothing has been announced. We don't know what Google is actually going to do, and we don't even know if Google's actually made this decision. But I think that one likely scenario, if I can just speculate a little bit, and again, this is my own personal speculation, I think there's a possibility that the low-end one could come out by Google I.O., and we're going to have some people at Google I.O. covering that show. And then the higher-end one, I think it would make sense for that to come out later in the year.
On its normal rev, yeah.
Yeah, and also to take advantage of the 64-bit Snapdragon 800.
Sure.
Which, if you're going to do a high-end phone, that's the thing you want to wait for. There are also reports that suggest that this could have a 3,200 milliamp battery, and it could be dustproof and waterproof, stuff like that. But again, this is all speculation and rumors. The Chinese site that talked about the low-end phone was actually a site that specializes in, of all things, MediaTek, which is a low-end chip vendor based in Taiwan. So, very interesting.
You know, the nice thing about some of these rumors, though, is that rumors are becoming more reliable and credible, especially when we have signature events like Google I.O. that always happens in the same time of the year in the calendar. And the same thing with Apple. You know, that we know that there's always hardware that comes out around the same time that a new operating system comes out. It's usually September, October. So I would think that those kinds of rumors are probably pretty good. And they also give consumers a nice way to gauge when are they going to give up their old phones, when are they going to start looking for a new phone, evaluating the market, and getting ready to make that purchase.
Yeah. Although you do never know, because this goes counter to another rumor that was pretty credible, which was that Google was going to get rid of the Nexus program entirely. So one of those is going to win.
Yeah, right. That's right.
We'll see which one it is.
Yeah, we'll see. It sure will be interesting. And personally, I'm rooting for the two phone policy. I think that would be a good. They really should keep this around. It's kind of it's kind of like a reference design. You know, it's a combination of a geek toy and a reference design. I think it's a great policy that they've had all these years.
Absolutely.
Well, an exclusive on Recode by Jason Del Rey said that Louis Borders, who was the founder of grocery delivery service Webvan, plans to launch a new Webvan-like service that some people are calling Webvan 2.0. You two probably aren't old enough to remember Webvan.
Oh, I remember Webvan.
And I worked in Silicon Valley, I think, in the late 90s, and we had a web van delivery service to the company, and we were just getting groceries all the time. We thought, everybody thought back then, you know, they had this big IPO, and I think it was 1999, and everybody thought, well, this is the future of grocery shopping.
So this was a grocery delivery service. Was it web-based for how you ordered at that point in time? I mean, the 90s is pretty early in web days.
Yeah, it was clearly too early for Webvan. And yeah, you go to the website and it was very nice. It was actually a very nice ordering process. And then literally a van with Webvan branding. I mean, they invested a lot of money in this thing. Of course, it went bankrupt in 2001. But, you know, this was a great service. And everybody thought, wow, this is just going to be fantastic. And they were the darling of the industry. They literally, when they went bankrupt, it was considered at the time to be the biggest bust of any startup ever, because they were flying so high when they were the hot new company.
Well, they probably had a lot to lose too, because they had to invest in a physical structure for that delivery, for inventory and all those kinds of things, where the boom that we saw in the late 90s, early 2000s, the boom bust cycle anyway, often had to do with no physical assets. So they had a lot more at stake, I would think.
Right. Now, you live in New York, and of course in New York City you can get anything delivered.
Absolutely.
One of the great which is great about New York. But
and I do use Fresh Direct, which I think is probably their biggest competitor. Yeah, I don't use it all the time. But you've got to remember, in a lot of cities, we don't have cars, and carrying heavy groceries into our walk-up apartments is often very difficult. So the convenience of paying a nominal delivery fee to have large containers brought directly to your door, they'll often just bring it right into your apartment too, is huge. And companies like Fresh Direct and others that really, maybe Amazon Fresh, which we never had in New York, but I know is expanding, they've really focused on getting that web part right. So the ordering process is good. The websites are clear. And as much as I see grocery stores, you know, the traditional retail chain grocery stores getting into the business of online ordering and delivery, they just don't have the web presence that Fresh Direct or Amazon has.
Right. And in addition to Fresh Direct and Amazon that you mentioned, there's also Google, Instacart, Relay Foods, and Peapod, and they're all sort of working on this model. I really think Webvan, when they came out, the whole problem was that they were just too early. They were they were 10 years or 15 years too early.
Yeah, in fact, Webvan, come back.
Yes, come back.
You have your name. You have your legacy. Right. Come back and do it right this time.
We're hungry. We're still waiting for the van. We have an order that hasn't been delivered.
So the news is that they are coming back?
The news is coming back. Yeah, the news is that the guy who launched it, whose name is Lewis Borders, intends to bring it back. And in fact, way back, you know, 10 years ago, he said, this is coming back. We're not done. So he's kept to that. And he's apparently planning to bring it back. It's not just that he wants to. He's apparently got plans in the works. And he's still an active VC or something. And he's out there doing lots of startup work. But he really wants to make this happen. And I think, you know, I hope he does. This is a great potential service.
Yep.
I think they still have to deal with the problem of what to do about fresh produce and things like that. That's really not, you really don't want somebody else picking your bananas for you. At least I don't. I'm kind of picky banana eater. Well, have you noticed that these days that technology is often described as creepy? Google Glass is creepy. Personalization is creepy. Humanoid robots are creepy. So Omer Tene, who is the VP of Research and Education at the International Association of Privacy Professionals, wrote a piece for Recode with Jules Polanetsky about creepy technology. It was a really interesting and fascinating article that really piqued my interest. And he's with us to talk about that today. Welcome, Omer.
Thanks, Mike.
So why is some technology considered creepy? What is it about some types of technology that creeps people out?
Well, we argue that creepiness is the feeling that resides in the rift that technology often creates between traditional social norms and new activities and behaviors. So you mentioned Google Glass with, you know, there's been a lot of talk and writing about the glass holes. How do you behave in public with something like Google Glass? We have no hard and fast rules for it. And there are a lot of historical examples also. So, you know, this isn't something that came up just over the past few years. When the Kodak camera came out more than 100 years ago, A couple of lawyers, one of them later became a justice on the Supreme Court, Louis Brandeis, wrote an article called The Right to Privacy, which still to this day is the most highly cited articles in law review history. So I think, you know, creepiness is a social norms phenomenon that's caused by the rapid acceleration of technological change.
You know, anytime I think about the word creepy in relation to technology, I think about the uncanny valley. So a few years ago when the uncanny valley was sort of first written about, it described that creepiness that you get from usually from animation, very, very good animation, where there's still some kind of recognition from humans that it's not real. And Polar Express, that animated movie, was always cited as the one that everybody could point to and say, yeah, there's something just uncanny and creepy about the way that these people are moving and interacting. Omar, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how humans feel about technology and technology invading their lives and recognizing something that feels human but isn't quite human, and how that comes into play with some of these social etiquettes around tech.
Yeah, I think, you know, humans are very unpredictable in their response to some of these technologies, which can augment the human senses or like change our ability to perceive things. So if you think of a facial recognition app or a service allowing you to sense which of your friends are in close vicinity to you geographically. And we often talk to engineers and to business managers who you know, are ahead of launching a new product or service. They want to know how to get privacy right. And oftentimes the answer is just, you know, try not to be creepy. So try not to create this backlash from this irrational sometimes backlash from individuals. The public doesn't really care about privacy notices or about legalese. They want to see value, and we kind of leave this to the engineers to solve. And they don't want it to be creepy or to creep out their friends. So engineers and business managers should be sensitive to this and kind of bring their consumers along with them for the ride.
Now, how much of this is actually valid, though, on behalf of the users who are concerned with issues about privacy, who have had issues of privacy violated before by big companies and by governments?
But explain the question.
Oh, I'm just wondering, you know, on the one hand, it feels creepy to have organizations who are collecting information about you that you're probably giving up willingly. But on the other hand, I think that there are a lot of people who feel legitimate in their worry about having information taken from them, having it used in ways that they didn't think was going to happen. So I'm just wondering if you think that there's another side to this creepiness where it's actually a flag for people. It's actually a good thing because it warns people to not be so giving with their personal information, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, I think there are examples that go both ways. So, for example, the Facebook newsfeed, when it was launched 6 or 7 years ago, had this initial privacy backlash from consumers. So, you know, you might not remember this, but before the newsfeed was launched, when you looked into your Facebook profile, you could see just that, your Facebook profile. So essentially your face, it was like a mirror. And then suddenly newsfeed appeared and you could see, you know, what's happening on your friends' wall, as it was called then. And people said, hey, this is creepy. You know, it's stalking. It's terrible. It's an invasion of privacy. But then, you know, people came around. Oh, this is interesting. So this photo of this friend's kid is kind of cute. And, oh, you know, he broke up with his girlfriend. And that's interesting. And now we can't even imagine using Facebook without the newsfeed. Like, you know, the other proposition kind of sounds ridiculous. But when, you know, even more lower tech example, when caller ID was introduced, people thought it was terrible. Like, my privacy is invaded if other people know I'm calling them. And now it's ubiquitous. So I think, you know, the public perception is sometimes fickle, but other times I totally agree with you, Jill, that the creepy reaction is kind of a red flag, which tells us that something wrong is going on. So if you think of the Target pregnancy score, the New York Times story revealing that Target was assessing whether shoppers were pregnant based on purchases of kind of innocuous stuff, you know, there was a creepy flag going up, and I think people feel it's wrong. So,
well,
it cuts both ways.
Yeah, I still think the Kodak camera is kind of creepy, personally. Omer Tenne, thank you so much for joining us on Tech News Today.
Thanks for inviting.
Appreciate it. You can find Omer on omertenne.com and also on Twitter at Omer Tenne. Let me spell that because it may not be obvious. It's O-M-E-R-T-E-N-E. Well, we got a voicemail from Chris in Tampa who expressed concern that the government-mandated kill switch we reported on this week could give the federal government the ability to shut down everyone's phones for political or other reasons. And, Jill, I think it's an interesting point that I haven't heard made, but I think that that is not a significant fear. I think that, you know, of course, you have to use your smartphone service through a carrier. And if governments, as we've seen in Turkey and elsewhere recently, have control of the carriers, if they can make the carriers shut off phone service or whatever, they could do that anyway. They don't need a kill switch to do that. And the kill switch, in any event, would be in the control of the carriers as well. So it's really all about the carriers and the degree to which a government has latitude to influence the carriers. Or am I missing something? Do you think he has a point there? Is this a risk we need to be worrying about?
You know, I might be a rose-colored optimist, as it were. And I think that there's a checks and balances that kind of takes place between government and industry, particularly with issues like this, where we need to have in place kind of protective measures that we hope don't ever need to be enacted, but that allow two parties to have some sort of governance over how those kinds of systems are used.
Yeah. It's a good point. And you know, for those who are concerned about it, you know, there's always, you know, shortwave radio and ham radio and stuff like that, which
going
can't be controlled.
School.
That's
yeah.
Right. Exactly. Check out Ham Nation here on the Twit Network. Well, Jill, thank you so much for coming all the way across the continent to be here on Tech News Today and also on Twit.
Someday. Absolutely a pleasure. It's really nice to be in the studio.
Yeah, isn't this a great place?
Yeah, it is. It's very cool.
Yeah. I really enjoy working here. So
it feels very high tech, which I think it should.
It absolutely is high tech. Well, again, thanks. Thanks for being on the show and being here in person. Appreciate it. Well, we want you to subscribe to Tech News Today. It's a really good idea, and you can do that at twit.tv/TNT. You can also join our Google Plus community and circle our Google Plus page by searching for Tech News Today on Google Plus. We're trying to get the community to 3,000 as quickly as possible. We just passed 2,000. Please do that. Also, we want to hear from you. Send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. And no matter what you do, don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, every weeknight tonight as well. So we want to thank you for tuning in. My name is Mike Elgin. We'll see you Monday.